Podcasting worldwide from Vancouver, Canada. Welcome back to the Personal Process Podcast. The show that takes you through the growth, hardship, self-discovery, lessons, and stories of individuals who achieved success in their own personal path. Trust the process.
Welcome back to the Personal Process Podcast. Today's episode, Giovanni Jose, my guy, and I'm very excited to hit this episode up with you, Giovanni. You know, you've done a lot of big things for Simon Fraser University, both of which we are alumni for, and you just keep killing it, my man. So how are you doing today?
Greetings, man. I'm happy to be here, and thank you so much for inviting me to come out. You know, it's all in COVID and everything. I'm no longer in Canada, but at least I'm here, chilling, yeah, and having fun as much as I can in this online world.
Absolutely, yeah. So for those that haven't been keeping up with you, where are you right now? What are you doing?
All right, so since graduating in June, yep. I was in Vancouver until September. My visa and everything kind of got through. And as you know, I got my return offer to Microsoft, working at Microsoft as a software engineer last year. In the summer, I did an internship there during my time at SFSS as well. And then now I'm here in Bellevue on the second night of election, just here chilling.
How's that going?
Oh, yeah, I'm in Bellevue, Washington. It's all right. It's pretty calm. I'm happy that, you know, people keeping level-headed and recognizing that it's a process, especially with the, you know, the unprecedented amount of mailing bots of this whole cycle.
Yeah.
And I'm happy that, you know, it's coming together nicely in terms of drama.
Yeah. No, for sure. So we got where you are now, which is really nice. But you know, we can't see just the metal before we see the hard work. So right behind you, we see a Jamaican flag. Is that right, Giovanni?
Yes, sir. Jamaica, big up to all Jamaica, all your audio with their friend. You know what I mean?
I love it. So would you consider Jamaica your roots?
Jamaica is so important to my life and to a lot of Jamaicans' lives out there. It's where we get our culture, it's where we get our roots, it's where we get our consciousness.
Right.
Jamaica really set me up to a better understanding of the world and making people recognize that, you know, no matter how small or how little the world might make you seem, you are much bigger than they might want to judge you. As in Jamaica, we have a term called, or a phrase called, we're little but we're talawa. And I think that's very important. It means you're small, but you have big impact. And I think that just goes to say, Jamaica is just just over 2 million people or 3 million people.
Yeah.
And such a great impact on the world.
Absolutely.
So I believe that Jamaica embodies my spirit.
Yeah, and I mean, I think just, and we're gonna get into this, because just your story and your passion for life in general is, it's, you know, you don't get that, you really don't. I think, to be honest, I'm not sure exactly how we met, but I honestly think one day I was just passing by you and I hear from out of nowhere, Wagwan, bruv! And you know, and at first I'm just, I have no idea what Wagwan means, and you know, I'm just like, who is that? What does he want? And then like, just the nicest smile on his face, and happy to call you a great friend, man. You know, it's been a pleasure getting to know you, seeing the accomplishments you kind of persevered in life. And just going back to that statement, doesn't matter, and I'm sorry if I'm butchering it a little bit, so feel free to correct me, but it doesn't matter how small you are, you can make a big impact. You know, like, I think we'll get into the movements a little bit after that you started and you initiated, but you know, like a lot of people weren't with you at the beginning, you know, like you were fighting against the machine, so to speak, but you still pushed through, you still persevered. And, you know, sometimes on 2 hours of sleep, but with the tenacity and vigor of someone who's like preparing for war. So I guess let's continue a little bit about Jamaica. So you're mentioning all of this culture and all of this impact that it had on your life. Can you describe how that culture is kind of transmitted? Is it through meeting? Is it through, you know, just like growing up? Do you mind talking a little bit about that?
I would say it's a energy, it's a vibe. Mm. We always talk in the Caribbean as a whole, it's a vibes. But yeah. What from a very young age and growing up, our parents, we moved to Kitsetown, which is red dirt, and yeah. You know, further away from the corporate era in Jamaica. And I just had a real tight knit network of friends, and a lot of us used to go out and we used to call ourselves like the Ski Boys, and a couple of us go play football. Just something where, you know, you go to school, but you know that one every week you come back and you link up with your brethren, you know, and you know, and you know, some of the fams who really supported us and came with us to, like, for example, football games. We used to create teams and pay for, you know, it's all about that community spirit and building camaraderie with a lot of people. And I think I really took that to another level when I also came here as well. And it's one thing, you know, bouncing that vibes off of people, is that vibes that I grew up with, and you know, build strong, solid, genuine friendships in my younger ages. And I'm happy and blessed to have had that experience, and I really embodied that when I saw people here, you know, try to make people smile. And yeah, that's been my thing.
And you've been doing a good job of that. Let me attest to that. So, Gio, so you had that culture down, and you mentioned soccer, but was soccer your main sport that you played back there?
No, definitely not. That's what my friends liked in my friend circle in Kitsetown. Yeah. But my sport from I've up since has been cricket. I started playing cricket in grade 2, I think.
Grade 2, wow.
And I started playing for my primary school in grade 4. And right. Ever since then, that just had been a passion for me. And even though I watch it a lot, but during my time, I played secondary school cricket for a long, long time, from grade 7 to grade 12, and we lost every single year. And in grade 13,
yeah,
we actually won the competition, and I took most wickets in the competition for that year. And it's just one of those stories, you know, grinding for long, and even though it's not, you know, turning out nice, in the end, it just really, you know, catapulted and made a real good story in the last year. It's kind of similar to what happened at SFU with the space issue.
Yeah.
But I wish we get into more, like, the cricket, it was my passion, and the last year of school I really, you know, met expectations and surpassed them in a certain way. And I'm happy for all the cricketers who came out and put their blood, sweat and tears into it. And then I played the university cricket for 1 year. Yeah. I actually went to university in Jamaica for a year.
Right.
Doing computer science as well before I transferred to Canada. So cricket has been a play in my life.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And kind of just going from what you're mentioning, you know, you're mentioning that, you know, you failed, and then you won. So that's kind of like what the whole process is, you know, the personal process podcast, you know, it's trusting the process, you know, like it doesn't matter what happens in step 1 or step 2 or step 12, step 13, ironically enough, it was your lucky number apparently. I guess, what lessons did you take from that? What growth did you have? What impact did that make on your life?
I'd say cricket is a really important thing in terms of people how to live. Cricket is a game of patience. Cricket is played over 2 days in high school. In real life, or in real life professional cricket, you know, world class cricket, it's played over 5 days. And it's something that really teaches you how to think strategically and how to not take too much, be strategic in the risk that you take. And if you're taking a risk, know that, you might be putting your team in a worse position. And so putting yourself in the eyes of making yourself be seen as a team player in such a way where you're not doing stuff selfishly.
Right.
And I think T taught me that, and that brought that into life. And I think that when it comes to patience, I think those formative years playing cricket and living life made me learn a lesson of no matter what, you just always try your best. Doing it for the passion, doing it not for the likes, not for the Facebook likes, but for the love. Right?
Hey, that's cool. Right there.
Yeah, man. Do it for the. So we don't do it for the love. We do it for the love. We don't do it for the likes. It's a song, and that's an embodiment in what you're doing. Like you try to do that in your life.
Yeah.
Because it's important. Even if you don't get the end goal, you're still happy with the effort that you put in. And I think that's one thing that I've been, really embodying.
Absolutely.
Especially in university years as well.
Absolutely. And I think I just want to kind of piece these things back together because I'm kind of forming a little bit of a puzzle, which I think kind of fits in nice. So, you're talking about the culture, about, like the vibes that you bring and, everyone's just giving it their best. And, we're talking about cricket where we trust the process and going forward with that. And then with this piece now, it's putting in all of your effort and going for that finish. And regardless of what happens, you're happy with it. And I think this is going to play into like other future events, which we're going to explore. So I'm really happy to keep going with this. So you play with cricket and you finish that. What's next on your process?
So right after high school, I went to university to study computer science. My computer science was that okay. It's not something that I really love, but I think that based on where the world and technology is going, I think it would be opportune to learn some of the skills around what's happening in 21st century.
Absolutely.
And I started to do a little computer science courses here and there, and then that's how I chose my degree, where I just thought, okay, let me go do my computer science. It has the cheapest. I actually wanted to be a pilot as a child.
A pilot?
Realizing that,
My guy.
I just didn't have the money. And I said that, the best way, when I look at the statistics, I was like, how I did my thing was very meticulous. I'll search it up and say, okay, it looked like it take 8 years to be a doctor, and I don't like bio. It take X amount of time to be a lawyer, and it's not that much money. But then I saw this thing called computer science and programming, and I saw 100,000 and 4-year degree. I was like, oh, that's all I need to do? Well, at the time, it was a 3-year degree. So I said, okay, that's my degree that I'm going to take, because it seems as if it's the minimal amount of
work,
labor that it take,
but
the maximum results. And that's what I saw. And you can make a lot of impact as well. And I think that's exactly why I chose that degree. And there was the next step after I was playing cricket at the same time in that first year, but that was the next step in terms of like my career trajectory, because I thought that was that could open up a lot of doors for me.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we got the analytical side of you, which feeds into the computer science. We got the passionate side of you. We got the side of you that, trusts the process and genuinely just wants to make the world a better place. As, what's that? I can't think of the word to describe that, as much as people say that. But, you genuinely embody that. There's nothing fake about that. A person meets you in 2 minutes, they feel that, They feel that vibe, if you will. And and I'm reiterating these things because once Gio goes into the stories that he's, and the stories that you've accomplished to this date, I think all of this will really, tie like a shoelace. So let's see, we go into university, computer science, we did the analyzing, computer science, best bang for your buck. What happens then? Because you started in Jamaica, then we're fortunate enough to meet at SFU. So what's that intermediate step?
So almost halfway through the year, I got a call from my brother who was in Canada for about 10 years.
Right.
And my there has been a process that I wasn't really aware of to the fullest extent.
Right.
And it turns out that my family and I, my brother filed for us to come up to Canada for a long time.
Really?
And that's how my parents and me, we all came to Canada at the same time, June 12, 2015. And we moved to Langley. So how I chose SFU, because I needed a school to go to.
Yeah.
I think it was in April, June, around them times.
Yep.
September is the school year. And or no, yeah, January, February, March. So March, April, about that time. And I started looking up and I said, okay, which school should I apply to? And then I look and I saw UBC deadline gone. And then I saw BCIT and SFU. And I said, okay, which school I think I can make, like, in terms of bigger impact.
Right.
And I think I decided SFU because I read, like, all of the readings and the research that I was doing was just that BCIT was very local to Vancouver and I wanted to have a wider scope. So SFU was definitely the ticket, and I chose it. And so, well, it was a day, that day that I looked up everything was a day that the deadline was for the SFU. And so my life has been literally on the line since from then time until now. And I applied, and then a couple of weeks I got in and said, oh cool, I'm going to SFU. Then we traveled, came the first day, met my first Jamaican friend on the first day.
Yeah.
It's like, hey man, what go on? Do you know anything around the campus where it's a voila? Yeah, Jamaican, this guy named Ocean. And then that's my first interaction when I went to campus. A guy from St. Mary's. So, oh, yeah, I hear that's same thing, because you know, you hear it. That was my journey here. And now, I did SFU for 5 years. In that first year, you know, I got involved as much as I could with computer science. And, you know, started, you know, fresh and the student union and tried to be as much as good as I can be. But you know, in that first year, it started to feel like a little bit isolating, and I think this is the, you know, the part of the story that kind of make people recognize that, you know, even though we might have the right mindset and stuff, there's systematic forces sometimes that kind of make you feel alone and make you feel as if you're not equipped to be in the spaces that you are. And I think building community became very, very important to me at that time. When I came to Canada initially, I was like, oh yeah man, everybody friendly, whatever.
Yeah.
Soon enough I realized that was not the case.
And
you know, people friendly, but there was a lot of social issues happening, and in classes people never really wanted to help you as much. A different environment. UWE, everybody chill. UWE was the party central of Jamaica. So, like, and this is the same people in computer science that was like running the parties, and like there was no nerd stereotype. But whereas I came here, people were a little bit more reserved, and you know, in classes I felt as if it was a little bit more difficult. So.
Right.
What I started to do was, like, you know, look out and, you know, started to look if there's any people like me or feeling any people who have similar experiences. And that's when I met Travis, who is engineering graduated like myself. And, you know, we started hitting it off, and then we got involved with SOCA. SOCA is the Students of Caribbean African Ancestry on Campus. It's a black student group. And I really found a big community there.
Right.
And through SOCA, we got opportunities such as, you know, being able to volunteer for Black Boys Code, an organization grown in Vancouver. It just hit 5 years. And, you know, building that community in campus, on campus with SOCA, and off campus, and building like mentorship and workshops and all of that. And that was a pretty good start to something that really catapulted to a big, even a racial and social awakening in myself, overall. And yeah, I think that was the first part of my SFU story, as you would say.
Yeah. And I guess when you were mentioning, just to back up a little bit, you know, you went to university and you thought everyone was nice, but you noticed certain factors that were a little bit off that may have not made your transition as smooth as you'd hoped for. Do you mind kind of talking about some of these? Like, what were some of them? Was it passive aggressive? Was it, you know, just not welcoming?
Yeah, so, you know, me and others had, you know, countless conversations around some of the experiences that, you know, we kind of went through. It's language of how people speak about, you know, black folks in the States when watching TV and stuff like that. In that time, there was a lot of police shootings and a lot of unrest, or racial unrest that's happening. And I found that that space that I was in was not very aware of the context of real, like real life, the black folks live with lived experiences. And I find that comments were made, N-words were being thrown around, that really made the space just uncomfortable. And I had to go somewhere else, because that's something that you kind of really dampens your spirit, even when you were trying to be the spirit in that space. And you know, I have other folks who have had similar experiences. You know, indigenous folks who said that, you know, people were, you know, rationalizing if colonialism was good in Canada and stuff like that in those same spaces. So I think that plus me building community which so gave me a better awareness of the issues around the world. Because like into school, I felt more like, you know, oh, everybody good, everything happening, you know, individualism. You can, even though I had community, you know, mandate and background, I also had, you know, the flawed narrative that meritocracy is everything. And I think that a lot of the time, you know, it's a missing conscious society as a whole, where, you know, a lot of, you know, opportunities that are for people if you have more resources. I think that those, over time, I learned that more and more because of my experiences that I've had. And I think it's important that even when you don't have experiences, you can, you know, start recognizing this stuff. And that consciousness really came up during those formative years at SFU.
Absolutely. So Sergio, do you mind just repeating that last little bit? I think it was cutting out near the end over there with regards to the formative identity. And yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just saying that, you know, those formative years of SFU is when I was able to build that consciousness of recognizing that, you know, wider scale systemic issues have a much bigger role than, you know, the individual meritocracy that, you know, society tries to tell us.
Yeah. And that's a very important thing, right? Because, you know, they usually say, you know, America's the land of the free, put in the work, get the result. But I think in a way that sometimes blinds those that may be institutionally hindered just by the way that society is talked about. And I think I kind of, you know, personally, I went through a big realization of this year, but you were able to understand this at a much younger age. Now, just to follow up on this, you know, a lot of people go through these experiences and, you know, they don't do anything. What inspired you to not only do something, but be an advocate that I think the majority of SFU students know?
I think if it wasn't for some of the experiences I faced, a lot of what came afterwards wouldn't have come. So in my third year, I would say, kind of building community in what we call the Rotunda community. So it's like all the community groups and social justice groups around that had space in the Rotunda. You know, building solidarity, First Nations Students Association, the Women's Center Collective, the SF Prague, which is like a social justice center, SOCA, you know, out on campus as well. We built a tight-knit network, you know, inviting each other to events and stuff like that. And I got elected as Soca president in 2016 or so. Yeah. But in 2018, we did, we got a letter from some group, which, to be honest, it wasn't the highest priority on my mind. I just know that they were building a building, and it's called the SFSS, the Student Society.
Yep.
And the letter says, hey, you have until a certain amount of time to, well, no, they called us into a meeting and said, hey, we need to talk about your eventual move out of the Rotunda space because this space is going back to SFU.
Right.
And I'm like, what? What's happening? And, you know, we started to talk more in terms of the Rotunda groups and said, oh, this must be something that, you know, the groups, the Student Society is trying to figure out how, you know, we can get into the building to learn about some of the history. And yeah, recognize that, you know, we were in original consultations. I was talked to the past president of Soca, and it was a given that the groups would have gotten space in the new building.
Yeah.
Long story short, new board, we met with the and the board at the time, and they just told us straight out that, oh, you have until December 14th to get your premises because the building is not being given to you, or you're not giving in the building. So, like, just come out and get all that equipment somewhere. And that just broke hearts, and yeah, that broke a lot of community spirit that we have built over a number of years. And that kind of really turned stuff around. I went to SFU for help. SFU basically said that, oh, this is not our thing. Even though SFU already doesn't have any space for Black communities, the one space that's there and it's under the Student Society, SFU is going to say that we will not get into student business. And I think it was very sad because it, you know, they ignored the issue.
Yeah.
In any case, the groups decided that, you know, we will still fight because this can't just happen. And, you know, we started to launch a petition and get hundreds of signatures, or thousands, I should say. And, you know, we did media, we talked to the media, and it was just very heartbreaking. But essentially, what happened in the following year was magic. We galvanized enough support to win a couple seats on the SFSS itself. And this is not something that you usually see a lot of the times, especially when, you know, groups who don't usually run in these things because it's a very exclusionary space,
yeah,
start to actually do it. And we got four to five people who believe in what we believed in,
yep,
elected to the board. And
yeah,
I was just say that was just a very stressful year,
yep,
but a year that kind of gave me the platform to share what was happening on campus, and that,
yeah,
catapulted us in a way where it wasn't for that, I have had attention to the issues to the extent where, you know, students started to support us.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and in the end, students supported us and condemned the board,
yep,
which I was a president of, but, you know, had in a minority on that board.
Yeah.
The board wasn't changing their mind.
Yeah.
But the students condemned them, and then in the end, the people who were opposing the groups caved in that, okay, and must be heard.
Right. Yeah. And just to reiterate, so Giovanni was the past president of SOCA, which is the Students of Caribbean and African Ancestry. And then he ran for the Simon Fraser Student Society, which is the largest student governing body of SFU. Represents over 26,000 students over three campuses, which are located in three different cities. So essentially, you were faced with an issue, and, you know, you used what you learned before. It doesn't matter if one person says no, in this case, SFU, you're gonna still push through. Doesn't matter if you're a few versus a lot, you're still gonna push through. And, you know, exactly what you mentioned, usually with these student society, what ends up happening is the incumbents usually form a slate or a political party, and they come in. And what ended up happening in your year, which was very interesting, is you guys got a lot of movement in your direction. You guys actually campaigned, you know, and what was shown in at least what I remember, there was a lot of spirit, you know. Before, campaigns would usually just be, hey, vote for me.
Yeah.
And after you get that vote, people would be like, okay, well, don't talk to him anymore. I already got your support. But, you know, like, I just want to share this one anecdote if I can. I hope I can. One of our friends, this is an anecdote to show you what kind of person Giovanni is. Wow. Okay. So long story short, Giovanni lives in between SFU, Simon Fraser University, the main campus on Burnaby, and Vancouver, somewhere in between. And my friend was headed up to Vancouver, and Giovanni was on a bus with him. And I believe you approached him, hey man, how's it going? Why go on? You know, just your bright self. And just started chatting. Now, my friend, who's actually been a guest on our show, Jordan Skripnik, you know, was just challenging him. You know, he's very data-driven, analytical, and, you know, he likes his little debate. And he was questioning him, little minor points. Now, I wasn't there, but from what I hear, this debate went on for, I don't know, 2 hours. And my friend was about to get off, Jordan, and Jordan was mentioning, hey, so where are you going? And then Giovanni mentions, yeah, it was like 10 stops back there. So, you know, like, that's who you are. You went above and beyond, you know, like 30 minutes out of your way just to make your points known. You know, a lot of people would have just been like, you know, especially people running for these positions, most of them would have been like, you know, it's just one vote, let me go away. But for you, it wasn't just a vote, it was a person, it was someone that, you know, actually wants to know about it. Like, I think that's why I have so much respect for you, Giovanni. You know, you're not just someone who says, you know, this isn't right. You go after it and you show it like 100%. And that keeps coming back to your, you know, past, you know. Even with this conversation with Jordan, failed once, still keeps cushioning. Darn it. Go further. But you know, you persevere and you get it. And you know, you're just one person, but you're making that difference. And he's just one person, but he's that important to you. You know, it's really something to be commendable, and it's something that I think I wish society had more of. Now, that was a solid little boost on you, but you know, you deserve it. So let's keep going. So you become the president of the Simon Fraser Student Society, and you've campaigned, you've garnered your support. What happens next? What are some big things that you've realized? Let's go actually, big things that you've done when you were there. And then we'll talk about the realizations, the lessons learned, the struggles. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think some of the most important things that I realized was people speaking up on the issues that they really, really care about. So around this time that I was fighting for, you know, space and against eviction by the student society, there were a lot of people talking about like financial duress that they were finding. And a group of organizers from the Left Alternative, which is my exposure to like leftist politics on campus, as well as SFPIRG and the TSSU, which is the workers, the graduate workers union. And, you know, they have undergrad members as well, but it's the TAs and sessionals. They started a movement. We started a campaign called the Tuition Freeze Now. And I think that really made me understand the political landscape of underfunding that happens when it comes to post-secondary education. And the universities have turned to international students and put in the financial burden on international students as well as domestic students to fill the shortfall of lack of funding or lack of prioritizing of post-secondary education in this land in Canada. And I think it was very, very important to, you know, put those issues right out there, you know. Yeah. And I think that's where a lot of support came. And through that, one of the biggest accomplishments is just bringing these issues out there. The SFSS had never really pushed back against tuition in the way that we try to push, and putting it on the radar of students has really galvanized students in such a way that they started to oppose things that have never been seen before. For example, just a couple months ago, I know that they, you know, there was an AGM where all the students came together and condemned the university. 2 years ago, this would never have been seen. And I think I planted a lot of those seeds of activism within the students and of like, you know, willing to shift against the status quo. And when it comes to indigenous sovereignty or black student rights or standing up for more marginalized students on campus, that lens was never put in the landscape of the student society. And I think we've gotten some big wins because of those radical positions that we've taken, where the students or even just SFSS as a whole kind of, you know, took their middle ground, which was a pretty big improvement on what was there before. For example, you know, we finally have a staffed FNSA coordinator at the SFSS, or even when it comes to student loans, pushing the government to put 0% interest student loans is a huge win when it came to the provincial government. And then as it came down into the last, you know, COVID came right in the last of our term, and we say, you know, we need to put money in the hands of students. And I know that before having these voices at the table, there would never have been a motion at the SFSS to put $150,000 back into the hands of students. Yep. The SFSS has been running like a corporate agency for year over year, running surpluses as if it's some business. Mm-hmm. And I think it was important to redistribute it to the people who needed it the most. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the more type of service-oriented advocacy activism style SFSS that I played a huge part in, you know, bringing new voices in to the dialogue.
Absolutely. So just kind of on that, I have 2 points. There's a quote who I cannot remember the author of, and it is, "Build it and they will come." Right. And oftentimes this is used for, like, for example, you want, you know, people at a baseball game, I think this is how it was originally, but don't quote me on this, build a baseball field in like a corn maze instead of, and cut down the corns in the corn maze, and people will come and watch a game, you know. But I think also, you know, a lot of people are afraid, you know, a lot of people are unsure, and it's hard being that first voice, you know, especially when there's a status quo and everyone does as such. And you really took that grain and did a 360, which would put it the same place. So we'll do a 360 plus another one. So what would that be? 520? I don't know, 540. Anyways, math is probably not the best freestyle when I'm running off a low amount of sleep, but you get my drift, right? You flipped that completely. And, you know, it's easy to say that you advocated and did this, but what was it like advocating against this position? You know, it's, and kind of just run us through, you know, student groups, students, professors, TAs, and even senior admin. Can you just kind of go through that with us?
Yeah, I think at first there, whenever I speak, I want to speak about like the student experience, especially students. I found that students were a little bit resistant at first because they didn't think it was possible or don't think anything is possible. And I think that just goes to show how much the student movement has been dwindled over the years. And what, in order to show a remedy to this stuff, it's important to dive that back into history and talk about what students won over the past 50 years that SFSS has been around. Oh, actually much more, some 60 odd, right? And I think I kind of made sure that I researched a lot of this history and talk about trends that has happened over decades in terms of underfunding, and really painted that story that this is possible, but there has been a concerted effort to make us think that it's not possible. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the biggest things that students hate is to be told that somebody was actually advocating against them. And I think when you actually put it in those terms, people recognize that, oh, we should be fighting back against this because somebody's making decisions that's actually against us and hurting us in such a way where we are being hurt and we don't even know. And I think opening with stories of past wins and past movements, and in the 1990s we had a tuition freeze for 3 years, so a tuition freeze in 2020 is much, much, much overdue, long overdue.
Absolutely.
And I think making people recognize those things was a big strong point in talking to students. When it comes to faculty, you know, a lot of faculty have their issues. A lot of faculty are being underpaid. A lot of faculty are not recognizing how much it is to with the students. So I have solidarity with some of the workers, because faculty members are workers as much as it is. Building solidarity between students and workers was very important. And I think while a lot of them were resistant, they started to understand the plight of students in a much better way. And that gave me an avenue to start having some of the more progressive faculty members speaking up in their, you know, in their caucuses. And when it comes to admin, I believe that admin is there to, you know, squash these movements. And I think it's important to work with, you know, students, student groups, faculty, and, you know, graduate workers together to build coalitions. And I think that's what we've seen this year, where they created a COVID-19 coalition to fight back for, you know, asynchronous learning or better learning opportunities. And I think, yeah, those were some of the better examples of how you can turn people into, like, you know, allies, but also I'll name four groups, and all, well, three out of the four are people who agree with you already. So I don't think it's a huge problem, but yet they have to know that they agree with you.
For sure, for sure.
And that's the educational piece.
Yeah. So just to reiterate, because it was cutting off, so, you know, the staff are with you, the students are with you, student groups are with you, but just the admins are kind of, you know, it's kind of their job. Like, it's, you should work together, but at the end of the day, they need to kind of figure out how to solidify their business. But what you're kind of getting at is we should all work together and, you know, convince the government to help us out, because we are all a team. And even with the government, we are, but we need to come as a united front, as a unit, and kind of go forward. So I guess, you know, I mean, let's use some of the vibes that we were talking about in the beginning and be hopeful that this reaches a member in the government, whether in BC, in the US, and we actually have listeners from New Zealand too, which is pretty cool. And it gets into some of their heads. You know, a lot of people say it's too hard. You know, a lot of people say it won't happen. And, you know, that ends up, you know, figuratively punching your motivation to go forward with this. If you could give the top leaders that would be able to increase the funding for education, what would you say?
I would love to speak directly to the people who are being hurt by a lot of the changes that are being made by the folks, and speak to them and say, like, speak up, make people know your plight, because there's more of us than they will ever be the decision makers. When it comes to the decision makers, I say to them, you need to start listening to the people who are speaking up, because essentially there's a lot of power in those small amount of votes that you have, and don't sell yourself out for votes.
Yeah.
Don't sell yourself out for amount of money that you get. Work for the people who elected you. And the way how you really make impact is by making impact on the lives of people. And if you're not doing that, then you're going to hell, I guess.
you know what, though? Like, minus the hell part, I gotta say, like, that's kind of the flavor of life, you know? Like, you gotta make your impact. And at the end of the day, like, I think that's what brings ultimate happiness. And I think that's how you have an, you, I swear, you must have had some sort of tattoo smile on your mouth, because you always smile. I don't know how many hours of sleep you're running at right now, but I can attest to days where I don't think you slept at all and you smiled way more than me. Yeah, but you know, I completely feel that. Yeah, so, is there anything else do you think that you want to kind of talk about this SFSS chapter of your life?
SFSS, and I think we have created a new era. As you know, I supported a lot of folks. We call ourselves the Progressives on Campus. In the last election, and 14 out of 16 of them win.
Yep.
So in the running outside of the political elite, to winning four seats, out of 16 to winning 16 out of 16. And over this year, they administered a restructuring process of removing all of the corporatists from, you know, the admin positions. They were spending 600+ thousand, or we were spending 600+ thousand just paying admins. And they've restructured all of that to one, going to split it to more of one as a governance role and one as an admin, you know, operational role. When it comes to governance, they just had a general meeting with student GM that happened since 2006. And I think all of these movement building that we did in our time really built the momentum for this board to continue doing that good work. And when I talk about BIPOC leadership, this is the first time that we had a Black femme Muslim woman running, a Black Muslim woman getting elected and running the SFSS in such a way that it's so tremendous, right? And I think it's with class consciousness as well, right? Yeah. And I think it's very important that, you know, even when we have representation, we talk about the policy as well. And that's exactly what's happened in the SFSS now, and I'm happy to see it. I'm here to see it. I've been cheering them on. And I think my year was not the year that could have implemented a lot of the big changes, but we have planted the seeds of change that could now you see things are blowing up. People are saying, yo, we need UBC AMS to be like SFSS, right? That's what you're hearing a lot across BC now. And I think there comes a time where SFSS shall be the a beacon of hope across the country, where we were in the 60s. So after the 60s, there was a lot of activism from SFU, and I think it's just coming full circle.
For sure. And I think just a little while back, I don't want to cut you off because you're giving a lot, but you're mentioning that, you know, like once this new president comes in, she kind of switched the whole deal. Before, there was pretty much very little progressives, but, you know, you planted the seeds, you know, I'm going to make this terrible analogy of you, you know, turned on the fryer and got the fries ready to throw in, you know. You know, like, you set all this up, but then now, like, SFU is really seeing that, like, these changes can't happen, and you're just kind of, you know, you're happy to see that as someone who's came to university and, you know, might have not had the best experience. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily directly have to be you doing the thing, but you're happy that, you know, you took one step forward, and then that one step inspired, kind of like the digits in my hand, many other people to go in the same direction. You know, you took the path less traveled by, as our friend, I believe Robert Frost, I'm butchering that, I'm probably gonna get slaughtered, took. And now you've made that path, and now everyone can see it and go through it. And who knows, before you know it, maybe that path goes much higher than the original path that was the preconceived notion of the status quo. And yeah, man, it's just really commendable. For those that don't know, like, going into something and putting your face out there and putting a view that may not resonate with everyone it's tough. It's hard on you mentally. It's hard on you physically. It's hard on you emotionally. It really goes the full circuit. And to see the changes that Gio has made, it really inspires me. Regardless of whatever stance anyone has, I think everyone can agree and should, in my opinion, that, you know, the strength and tenacity that you portrayed is just, I can't say anything else other than commendable. You know, it's something that inspired a lot of other people to do what they do now. And who knows, you never know what one action does to the next. And, you know, that goes back to the vibes, you know, that goes back to the culture, that goes back to the upbringing, that goes back to the fact that, you know, you struggle, and then you hit it. And it doesn't necessarily have to be you. In cricket, you learn that it's not just about you, it's how the team works. You know, you supported them and your team now got the goal. doesn't matter that you didn't get the goal, your team still won and is continuing to go that route, right? And I think, you know, this is kind of why I was trying to reiterate all these points. You know, everything in life is a lesson. The struggles, the hardships, the wins, the cheers, the cries, the tears. And, you know, this is just one part of your journey. And how old are you right now, Gio?
25, I think.
25, I think. I've hit that age before. I forget my age. Yeah. You know, you're only 25 years old. You're only 25 years old. And also, just for the viewers watching on YouTube, if you see that beautiful poster right beside the Jamaican flag, that's my guy's poster over there for running for election. And honestly, I'm really happy with what you've shown people. And regardless of political view, just that if you believe in something, go for it. Yeah, so I think that sums it up pretty nice. Is there anything else that you think you want to add in for the SFSS?
Oh, I think that's it for the SFSS. I think just, you know, keep. I think one thing we did was, you know, bring certain voices there, but now it's about expanding. So, you know, these changes that are being made now to make the board not just 16 people anymore, but 40, 50, 60 people from all different aspects of people on campus, or different student groups all having a say at the table, is one of the most democratic that has happened for a long while. While, you know, you have a smaller exec. So these are huge changes that are being made, and I'm happy for that. I think that was a good chapter of my life, and I'm just happy to support them.
Absolutely, man. So what happens after the SFSS? What happens then? Was that when COVID hit?
Yeah, so COVID hit right at the end of my term. Right after the newly elected folks got elected, and I started to organize with the Black NBC Mutual Aid for COVID. We raised $160,000 and distributed $90,000 so far. And, you know, really trying to, because Black folks have been disproportionately hit by the impacts of COVID, you know. Yeah. Financially, socially, and health-wise, and I think it was important to, you know, be a part of that, to try and, you know, raise funds as much as I can. Since I moved, I've not been involved anymore, but it was a very important thing to do right after graduating. And then I also, like, you know, got much more involved with Black Boys Code again, and I ran four workshops over the summer. I wanted to go all over the world in the summer, but I couldn't because of COVID. So that was my calm down. My calming down was doing a lot of work in the community, which was good. You know, I got a month to kind of, I use August to just de-stress as well. You know, saw my partner, just lived with her for a month, basically, which was good. And then I moved to Seattle on September 11. And I started work on September 14. Got everything within 3 days. So,
how was that like?
Yeah, Seattle is nice. Or Bellevue. I'm in Bellevue, but the area is nice. It's pretty similar to Vancouver. Onboarding has to be challenging because it's all online. But my teammates have been really helpful and really open to having phone calls and talking, because everybody recognized how hard it would be to onboard in the midst of a pandemic. And I have to give a shout out to the leader of the team, who's, you know, kind of really giving a lot of support. Daniel has really been good in helping everybody onboard or feel good about, you know, not being around.
Shout out to Daniel. So so right now you're at Microsoft, right?
Yeah.
So how does that feel, you know, because I'm personally, you know, I'm a science student, so, you know, doctor is probably the end goal for me, and that's kind of what I've, you know, reflected on and seeing that. And I think for a lot of software students, you know, computer science students, the end goal is a big tech firm, Facebook, Uber, Microsoft, all those big names. And, you know, you got it right out of the get-go, you know, like you had a vision when you were in, when you just graduated from high school, you went to computer science in Jamaica, and you're like, 4 years, you know, 100K, you know, sounds good. I'll do it. And you know, you get it right out of the get-go, and these aren't easy competitions. So like, how do you feel? Like, how was the process of actually, you know, getting that offer, getting that seat, getting the letter to say you're in?
Yeah, I think one thing I did really well over the course, and I think it's very important to like talk about that part, but the schooling and the academia is fine, but I thought that, you know, doing co-ops was very, very important. So I had built a very good LinkedIn presence, because I'm not the smartest guy around. I'm not like, yeah, as you know, I did a lot of stuff at school, so my grades weren't to the T. It's my GPA was not over 3. So I built up a lot of presence online. I did a lot of, you know, practicing for coding interviews and started to try and really get co-ops and kind of mentor other people to get co-ops as well. So I got my first co-op in 2017 at SAP in Vancouver, and in 2019 I did the co-op at Microsoft. And there is when I got my return offer. But like, you know, fun fact is I never even applied for Microsoft. I applied so
that the
D, yeah. So the 20, well, I applied after, but like, so 2018. I was grinding hard for a tech company. I really wanted to work at a company in the summer of 2018. And I grinded. I had like 7 final interviews. I applied with this company called Jobwell.com. And like, I just been doing interviews like crazy. And for every one of them, I interviewed at Google, I interviewed at LinkedIn, Lyft, Next, or a company named Next, and I think 2 other companies. I'm not remembering off the top of my head right now, but interviewed and went to the final round for almost all of them.
Right.
And I failed all of them. None of them came through. 2018 was sucky, but I still pushed through. And then like in the end of the year, when it was the whole eviction thing came, and then in spring 2019 I failed all my courses because it was all of that, you know, the whole SFS stuff, and everything was like, you know, crushing. It was rough, but right in the midst of that, I got an email a LinkedIn message from a recruiter. Hey, we have a Microsoft position open up. We have internships going on, and we have an interview slot open up at SFU. Do you want to do an interview at SFU for the first round? And I interviewed without applying for that first interview at SFU at the Microsoft recruiting drive. And I interviewed, it was well done. I got a question that I got I really have a good understanding of. And then they flew me out in October. You know, 4 back-to-back interviews from 8 o'clock to 12 o'clock. I remember it very well. I partied the evening after that. and then I came back to Vancouver, and 2 days I had an offer in my hand. And I think that's really, you know, a good lesson in terms of like, you know, getting some real sad times the year before, or the same year actually, because I interviewed in 2018, the November 2018, October, November 2018.
Yeah.
But like earlier, failing courses, failing interviews, and you know, just having a hard time, you know, fighting SFSS and all of that. So it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
So that's how I got this job, because like I did well at interview at the start of the internship. This is starting to be a theme, I guess. But the start of the internship, I started really slow. And I needed to, like, you know, basically at the six week mark, I needed to do some improvements, because like one of the first projects was just hard for me and I couldn't like get over it. So I needed extra help. And then the last 6 weeks or the last 4 weeks, I did 2 3-week projects in the last 4 weeks. And then like, because of that, I killed a presentation, and then I got the return offer. So that's why I'm here. So it's like, you know, fitness strong after pressure of starting slow.
And then just to kind of put it into perspective, so not only did you have these projects, but did you do something else in the meantime during the internship?
During the internship, you know, there were a couple events that were happening, like, you know, International Day and, you know, Intern Day. And, you yeah. know, you go and dance. There was this whole Jamaica thing, too. I brought the Jamaica yeah. flag and you started making everybody dance. So you can go and yeah. look on Instagram. It's like the whole, like, batch, the whole intern coordinator for all hundreds of interns that was there dancing.
Yeah.
And that's kind of cool. And, you know, volunteering here and there with other things that they have out there, like Blacks at Microsoft.
Yeah. Just a little side thing. If you ever want your party to go fantastic, invite this guy. You don't need a DJ. You don't need anything. Just give this guy a table. Star Drew. Everyone's going to have an A-plus time. Oh, man. Yeah, it's just, you know, it's just such a fantastic story, you know, and your story just fits in such a nice puzzle. I don't know if you kind of see like what pieces I'm throwing into, but like, you know, it's just the hardship, you know, it's the culture, it's your upbringing, and it's the advocacy. And I think, you know, a lot of people go through hardship and some go into painful coping mechanisms, whether it's drugs or, you know, just watching TV to get rid of it or playing video games obsessively to get rid of it. But one thing that I just want our viewers and listeners to pay a note to is you use that energy, you know, you use your energy of hurt to drive yourself forward, you know? And I think it's sometimes just not even considered because it is a little bit harder, but you know, when pain hits us in life, it's, what do we do with it? We can go exercise, we can go, you know, change the world through advocacy, or we can do things that aren't good for us. And we know it's not good for us, but it's easier. And I just want you guys all to know, whether you're at a good place in your life or a bad place in your life, this is one medium that you can use. And you can even express yourself through poetry or music or dance, as my guy likes to do, you know? Yeah, so I think all of those points are very big. And I think we've hit a very like encapsulating picture. So I guess just a couple kind of little things to summarize, not summarize, but going forward, what's your plan? You know, like what's your vision? What's your hopes? What are you feeling? What's your vibes, bro?
You know, it's all about impact. You know, I'm here to continue to try and make impact as best as I can. And
yeah.
The story will go up and down. You have ups and downs here and there. Yeah. Currently, I'm in a down, maybe. You know, challenging projects.
Yeah.
Hard time onboarding, being alone at home. But, you know, having people around or, you know, online, creating new avenues of, you know, working with people. I use this app called GatherTown that, you know, it's like you're working your character, and if you go up to a person, you see their video comes up and then you can run away from them if you want to stop talking to them. So those are kind of cool stuff that I try to do to keep myself upbeat.
Have you run away from someone yet?
Yes, I go up to my partner and I run from her sometimes. All right, no more.
Oh, man.
Kevin, she's amazing. But like, yeah, it's a bit like going forward, you know, it's just having all of that into perspective and recognizing the stuff that's happening around and, you know, pulling voice to that. I don't want to be the bird person that you hear, you know, get a job and then forget about the importance of, you know, advocating for certain changes. And I've been making my voice very, very clear on those in the same issues. And I think there's room to do that even here at a company as well. Because Microsoft have so many employees, and that's a network of people that you can really start to, you know, galvanize and make people recognize that, you know, there's stuff in the world that needs to be fixed. And whichever capacity I'm in here, if it's senior leadership in a couple of years or 10 years or 15, whichever, I'll be trying to drive impact here as well.
That's fantastic. Gio, I think, other than just like a final, you know, message to the viewers, whoever's listening to this, if you want to inspire them, if you want whatever you want anyone to know, what would you say? And that's a very big question, and I'm putting this on the spot, so, you know, just putting that out there.
I always say, just, you know, don't be afraid to build community and advocate for what you want, right? Feel free to link up and sync up. Link up, sync up.
There you go. You know, you're a computer science major. Omega, that computer science major. There you go. Love it, Gio. So, Giovanni Ozang, thank you so much, sir, for being with us today. I am super glad we did this. You know, I really felt connected with you throughout this, and I think it's, I really hope it's going to change people's thoughts on what they can do, you know, to realize that if you don't hit it once, twice, 12, the 13th time will work for you, right?
Well, from 7 to 13, yeah. What's that? 7 times.
Yeah.
7 times the number.
Yeah, you know, and you know, like, that's huge. Anyways, my friend, thank you very much. And to the viewers of the Personal Process Podcast, or the listeners, because we've actually gone on YouTube now. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching, and stay tuned. Personal Process Podcast out.
Hey guys, Parham back after another amazing episode with another amazing guest. We hope we added value into your life and you took away some tips that you could add to your tool belt and fuel your process forward. If you do know any friends or family members who would enjoy the same value that you got today, we'd really appreciate if you told them and let them know about us. And, you know, if you could also subscribe and rate the podcast, well, that would just be fantastic. If you did all three, well, you'd really fuel our process forward. So thank you in advance. And always remember, trust the process.